Please turn to John chapter 5 as we begin at verse 9 through to verse 18. John chapter 5, verses 9 through 18. William Ernest Henley wrote a poem. The poem that he wrote is named Invictus. And it says this: "Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced nor cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody, but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade. And yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." Invictus, which means unconquered, in Latin could be considered the anthem of the human soul. It is a treatise to the human desire to command our own lives and bow down to no one. And it vividly describes personal autonomy and the authority of the self. When directed to those things that would try to challenge our authority and call for submission, it is a declaration of war. A war that the human spirit is even willing to engage in with God. Last week we saw Jesus display His grace as He healed a man suffering for 38 years from an affliction that left him unable to walk. He was unable to undo the consequences of sin, but Jesus had compassion on him. And in this merciful act, Jesus displayed His authority over the power of sin and the frailty of the human body. And this led us to express a principle that we learned so far in this story. And it's this: that Jesus extends authority over a person by and as grace. In the remaining portion of the story before Jesus explains at length His authority, we see a response of the Jews. What we are going to find out is that those who have held authority not only want to reassert it, but they are bold enough to try to challenge Christ's position and His person. They declare to Christ boldly of their unconquered soul. And it reveals the heart of man and the precarious position even we can face as Christians. So we pick up the story where Jesus confronts the man. And we begin at the last part of verse 9 through verse 13. "Now that day was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed.' But he answered them, 'The man who healed me, that man said to me, "Take up your bed and walk."' And they asked him, 'Who is the man who said to you, "Take up your bed and walk"?' And now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in that place." We start from the end of verse 9 so that we are reminded, because it's important, that it is the Sabbath. And the Sabbath was, of course, important for Israel as it was founded in the creation story, and it was commanded in the 10 laws given at Mount Sinai. The Sabbath law was intended to provide rest physically, but more so it was designed by God to give people a dedicated time as an opportunity to know God and reflect upon His love and on His blessing. As with most things that are created by God, and then people get their hands on those things, the Jewish leaders took that merciful gift that was intended to remind people of their need for God, and they distorted it. And they provided all these rules that tried to make it into something that can be kept without God. There are 39 categories of work that are prohibited on the Sabbath, according to Jewish rules. And most have no basis in the Bible. On that list, the very first prohibition is the one that Jesus commanded the healed man to do: to carry something in public. And the story says that the Jews, who are should be understood as the religious leaders, they found the healed man and they reminded him that it was against the law for him to carry his bed. To which the man responds by appealing to the command, command that Jesus had given him as the reason for him breaking the rule. The Jews then pivot their attention to Jesus and they want the healed man to reveal who would encourage him to do such a thing. And the man responds that he has no idea who healed him. And in this encounter between the Jews and the healed man, we discover a couple of things. The first thing we discover is that the healed man acknowledges Christ's authority. Looking at the healed man's answer to the Jews' initial question seems to indicate that the man may have been trying to transfer blame from himself to Jesus for the reason that he was breaking the Sabbath rule. In one sense, he was saying that he was only doing what he was told. It wasn't his fault. He was responding no differently than when Adam blamed Eve for eating the forbidden fruit, or when someone, say, in the military says that they were only following orders. In such cases, they rarely get away with passing the blame. And it looks like he even would have pointed Jesus out if he could have, if he would have known him, and he would have tried to turn the attention off of himself. But Jesus has slipped away into the crowd. This is the default reaction of most every person. And to be honest, we come by it, I think, quite naturally. We will always want to preserve our own lives as part of our base and consistent instinct. And it's part of our problem. The base problem, I think, in many occasions, is selfishness. Richard Baxter went so far as to say this. He says, "The state of an unconverted man is this. He lives in his carnal self, or to the flesh, and the main bent of his life is that it may go well with him on earth." Baxter's words are particularly troubling when I think about myself and my own life as a Christian. And I can find myself at different times where he says it's unconverted people. I think I find myself at times being able to put in there converted people. In another sense, maybe in a positive one, hopefully a positive one, the healed man is admitting that the one who healed him attained authority over his life, even though it was directly opposed to the rules of the Jews. Jesus had given him mercy, and because of this gracious gift, he did not hesitate to listen to him. And this is essentially what it means to submit to authority. It is listening to, and also in the sense of doing, but it's listening to what a person in authority says. One kind of authority is like the Jews who commanded obedience with the threat of punishment. This kind of authority, which is understood as maybe that being held by a police officer who has the rights to pull you over with his lights and with his sirens, and he commands you to move to the side of the road. You listen because you fear his power to inflict punishment. This was not the authority that Christ displayed to this man. Jesus did not belittle him for his faith in the rumors of these waters that would stir up and somehow maybe give him healing. He didn't chastise him for his sin that had put him in that position. No, Jesus exercised the authority that is displayed out of grace. He cared for this man, and the man responded by doing what Jesus commanded. Colossians chapter 3 tells us that as one who is raised with Christ, as ones who have died to sin, who have been forgiven and are loved, we are to obey God. Do we submit to His authority because it is right, or because we fear discipline? Now, those are certainly good enough reasons. But what makes submission to Christ's authority a delight is doing so as ones who are giving our all to the one who gave all to us. We are much better served and will find much greater motivation by obeying Christ out of love because He first loved us, not out of guilt or out of fear. Brian Chappell writes, though the Bible uses many motivations to help secure our obedience, one command exceeds all others: love for God, which motivates lives that honor Him and bless those he loves. I am convicted. I was convicted this week to ask for your forgiveness as my church. Not for calling you to obey, or even doing so because it is right, or because the Bible says so. I ask for your forgiveness for the times I have not proclaimed prominently that obedience and submission to Christ's authority should be motivated by Christ's compassion and His grace and His love. I think what I have done is that I have feared that it would leave room for license to sin. And so rather than calling us to respond to grace, I've called you to put your noses to the grindstone. And I'm asking God to teach me more deeply what He says when He says in Titus chapter 2, 11 to 12, "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age." It is grace that trains us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions. Now, would you say that you submit to Christ as your authority? And if not, what might that say about the reality of your relationship with Christ? If Christ is your authority, is it out of fear? Is it out of pure obligation? Or is it because He has extended His grace to you? If we are losing the battle to renounce ungodliness and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives, Maybe we're operating out of fear. Or maybe we're walking out of obligation and not out of grace. Second, the Jews were focused on law keeping. The Jews witnessed that this man had been healed. Not because they saw it done, but because they knew him as one of the people that was at that pool probably every day. And their response to the man being able to walk is telling of their hearts and of their motivation. Notice that they express not a single hint of joy. We have thought that they would have at least said something like, "Oh, I'm really glad that you can walk." And it reminds me of the times, embarrassing as it is, that I have come into our recently cleaned home, and rather than hugging my wife and saying how much I appreciated her for all the hard work, I simply point out, "Well, you missed that spot there." They didn't see His healing. They saw a mess that remained, at least in their minds. They only saw that this healed man defied their authority by violating their Sabbath rule. They did not rejoice with him, they chastised him. These Jews were legalists. And what does that mean? C.J. Mahaney says, "A legalist is anyone who behaves as if they can earn God's approval through personal performance." Gaining God's approval through personal performance. They not only applied this to themselves as some standard that they then imposed on God, but moreover, they went further and imposed those same standards on everyone else. They were saying to God, "You will accept people because they don't carry things on the Sabbath." And to people, they said, "You will not carry things on the Sabbath to be acceptable to God." And in the end, they were trying to have authority over man and over God. What becomes of it are two things that jump out at me from this story. One is that legalism does not allow for compassion. The Jews could care less if this man was healed. Their entire concern was for their precious law. I am reminded of a moment when I maybe hear someone from our household who tells me they got in a car accident. And the very first thought in my mind, can you tell what it might be? Or the first words out of my mouth were, "How badly damaged is the car?" When we gravitate towards legalism, we will not put the care of others first. And could it be that when we fail to have mercy, when we fail to have compassion upon them, is perhaps it's rooted in our rule-keeping? The second thing I observe is that legalism is against thanksgiving. Why is that? Well, because thanksgiving or gratitude are expressions that can never be shown to oneself. Giving yourself on a pat on the back for what you have done is not gratitude. It's pride. And that is the problem. When rule-keeping is the criteria for achievement or acceptability, if a person is successful, who do they thank and how do they feel? I'm in the midst of working on a course for my degree, and I'm working on a research paper, and I work really hard, and I put in all these weeks of work and hard work, and then I get my mark back, and I get a 97% on that exam, or on that research paper. How can I act and how can I think? My achievement was being evaluated by how I did on that paper, and so who do I thank? I'm not going to thank my professor. I put in all the hard work. How am I going to feel? Well, if I'm consistent in getting 97s and 98s, maybe I think that I am the best research paper writer in the world. Maybe. Who knows? The Jews did not want to know who healed the man so that they could thank Jesus. They wanted to hold Jesus accountable, to have authority over him. They wanted to hold him accountable to their legalism, to their rule keeping. They could not praise Christ because all they could consider is that their rule was not being kept. The law that allowed them to boast in their own ability to please God rather than admitting that they were actually paralyzed spiritually and they needed Jesus to heal them. When we are in droughts of gratitude, could it be that our thanklessness is the outcome of our legalistic heart? Now, I have a tendency to be a legalist. And I think there are more of us in the church than there are those who think that their faith gives them the right to act any way they would want to. I am naturally a bit also a rebel against authority. So I don't like other people's rules, but I like making my own. And I don't have a problem imposing them on you either. And you may be a person who is the opposite of that. You may be a rule follower. You might be a best practices kind of person. You might be a person who not only wants to follow the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law as well. I am certainly not that. But I can't point fingers. Because as a society, as a world, the whole thing is set up for us to be legalists. Legalism prospers in our society. It's the product of the condition of the sinful human heart. And this kind of, the takeaway from this is that the Jews and their encounter with this healed man were saying this. At least this is what's communicated. The world will always try to reassert its authority over us by the law. That's what it will always try to do. If we apply this to our relationship with Christ, we end up wanting our legalism to be the authority that subjects God so that He is obligated to save us, to find us acceptable, and to bless us. And I know the outcome of this. It is one of two things. It either leads to pride or it leads to despair. If we embrace legalism, we will perish clinging to self-righteousness, or we will believe that there is no hope because we can never be good enough. And I would like to commend to you, not legalism, but Christ's grace and His love. The Jews appeal to the authority of their rules. May we learn that we can only appeal to the authority of Christ's grace and His love. What do you and I want What do we want as far as rules over us? Do we want arbitrary and hypocritical laws and lawmakers? Or do we want Jesus? I hope we will find much greater motivation and hope in Him. In Ephesians 2, 4 and 5 it says, "But God, being rich in mercy, because of the great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved." And I would encourage you to take a closer look at perhaps what you are doing and ask if you are doing it out of love for God or your way to gain God's approval. Do you find compassion and gratitude withering, but pride or despair growing? This might mean that legalism has filled your heart, and I would encourage you to call out to Christ to lead you to your knees and to ask Him to fill you with His grace and with His love. So we see the Jews confronting this healed man. Now let's turn to verses 15 to 18 to see how the Jews confront Jesus. "The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him, and this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because He was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, 'My Father is working until now, and I am working.' This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill Him, because not only was He breaking the Sabbath, but He was even calling God His own Father, making Him equal with God." Have you ever found yourself incredibly frustrated about maybe something that you bought at the store? And so maybe you take that item, you box it back up, you bring it back to the store, and you bring it to the, say, the cashier, or maybe the returns department, or whatever it might be, and you complain. And maybe you complain very vehemently, maybe very loudly, however you complain, however pretty or unpretty that may look like. What good did that do? Shouldn't you have taken your complaints to the manufacturer at the very least? That would be the better thing to do than to subject the poor cashier or the poor person at the return counter with all of your complaints about something they could not fix. And this is what the Jews did when they confronted the healed man. They were talking to the cashier when they should have been talking to the manufacturer. And now that's what they do. They turn to Jesus. And after Jesus finds the healed man in verse 14, He goes to the Jews and He tells them that it was Jesus. The healed man does that. And John does not record Christ's altercation, all the conversation with the Jews at this point. He doesn't do it in a straightforward manner. It's more like a combination of narrative and commentary. And what seems to have occurred is that the Jews found Jesus and they confronted Him. That's where it talks about His persecution that He's receiving. They confront Him because Jesus has healed on the Sabbath. And it looks like the Jews may have asked Jesus a question, something like this: "Well, why did you violate the Sabbath rules? And then why did you tell this man to take up his bed and walk? Why did you tell him to carry his stuff and leave?" And Jesus' answer is kind of shown in verse 17 and leads the Jews to want to kill Jesus because He's breaking the Sabbath, or more so, He's breaking their Sabbath rules. And on top of that, Jesus just makes it worse for Himself, in a sense, when He says that He is equal with God, or at least that's how they perceive it. The religious leaders should have the best knowledge, should they not, of what it means to follow the Sabbath and of the laws. And they should have also known, more than possibly anyone, the scriptures that were concerning the anticipated Messiah. In fact, later in John chapter 5, verse 39, Jesus chastises these same Jews for searching the scriptures for eternal life, but completely overlooking that all of them give witness to Him. "Here stands the one for whom they were looking, and they could not see Him, rather than receive Jesus." They challenge Him, and they do so in two ways. First, they challenge Jesus' position. they were persecuting him because Jesus was breaking the Sabbath. We see that in verse 18. But was Jesus really breaking the Sabbath? He wasn't at all. Jesus was certainly breaking their Sabbath rule, but he was not breaking the Sabbath. These Jews believed that their rules were as authoritative as the Sabbath law itself. They believed that they could and they should determine God's law, and therefore they made themselves authoritative over the Scriptures. In another instance, recorded in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus challenges this perspective when the Pharisees criticized Christ's disciples for plucking grain to eat on the Sabbath. And in verse 7 and 8 of chapter 12 of Matthew, Jesus corrects them in the context of having mercy, and he says, "He is the Lord of the Sabbath." What Jesus is saying in Matthew is that doing good on the Sabbath does not violate it. And in fact, he is authority over the Sabbath. The Jews misunderstood that mercy was more important than rule keeping. Jesus was not breaking the Sabbath by healing the lame man. He was acting perfectly as the one who is authority over the Sabbath. On the seventh day, God rested and established it as a Sabbath when he created the universe. It's a day for physical rejuvenation, for spiritual rejuvenation. But notice what Jesus says in verse 17. He says that the Father and the Son are both working. Now we might have had this idea, perhaps, I don't know if you have, I've never thought about it greatly until now, but we may have had this idea that God took the Sabbath off. That He does that even to this day. Every seventh day He takes that day off. But think about it. According to Mark chapter 2, verse 27, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The rest was meant to help people. God does not need a Sabbath. The Bible, in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3, indicates that Christ upholds the universe by His Word. And that means that He is constantly working to keep the universe running. He does not take days off, because if He would, the whole world would fall apart. Think about it further. Think about it as in terms of the role that Christ has as the one who intercedes for us before the Father. And what that means is that when we sin, and the Father sees that, Christ is our advocate, who says, "They are my child. They are holy. They are pure. They are saints through the work that I have done and imputed to them." But what happens if Jesus takes the Sabbath off and we sin on that day? Do we go that whole day under the condemnation of God? We do not, because He doesn't take it off. Think about it in regards to prayer. You have a need for prayer. You receive bad news. You are dealing with trauma, maybe fear and failure. And so you sit down to pray. But it's the Sabbath. And God takes the Sabbath off. So all you get is a dial tone. There's no one there. I think it's a terrible thing to consider that one day of the week, God might not be available. That He would have a day where we do not receive His mercy. That there is a day each week where His grace and His compassion and His provision and His healing and His encouragement are not available to us. What a terrible thought. Our God is always maintaining His creation. Jesus is always our advocate. The Father is always available to hear our prayers. The Holy Spirit is always ready to enlighten the truth of the Scriptures to our minds and to our hearts. The Trinity does not take holidays. He does not have me days. He does not take Sabbaths or Sundays or any other day of the week off. The Jews challenged Jesus' position as Lord over the Sabbath, but this insurrection was only a small part of their rebellion. And because it extends to all the Scriptures. Remember that these Jews were God followers, and so is every Christian. And that means we have to consider the ways that we try to challenge Christ's position. Do we try to modify or add to God's law so that it might suit us? Do we take our pen and we add to the Scriptures, or we grab an eraser and we try to erase away some of the parts that we do not like? Maybe we say we don't do that. But each time that we ignore, each time that we neglect, each time that we modify God's instructions to us, that is in fact what we do. We place ourselves as authorities over God, and we place ourselves as authorities over His Word. So they challenged Jesus' position, but they also challenged Jesus' person. What I mean is that they objected to Christ's claim that He was God's Son. Now, we might not understand what the problem is when I say this, because the way human relationships work is not the same as the Trinity. If a person claimed to be the son of, say, the most powerful person in the world, well, we might not get entirely upset. They do a DNA test, and if it turns out to be true, maybe we still don't get upset. We don't get upset because the Son is not the Father. They don't share the same power. They don't share the same position. They don't even share the same character. For instance, if the Father is a president, that does not mean that the Son is the president. But in the Trinity, when Jesus claims to be God's Son, He's not saying He is the same person, but He is saying that I hold the same power, I hold the same position, I hold the same authority. He is saying that He is equal with God. He is, if the Father is king, Christ is also claiming the throne. So the Jews are a little upset. And as we know, like any rational person, they immediately conclude that He must die. Why would they not treat Jesus just like a crazy person and ignore Him? It was because Christ's person, as the Son of God, challenged their authority. Jesus was claiming divinity. He was here on earth as the ultimate authority that superseded all powers and all persons and all positions. Probably one of the biggest things is that Jesus completely devastated their understanding of the Scriptures, the perceptions of the coming Messiah and its foundation, and their entire understanding of God. They had put everything together. It was all nice. It was all tidy. They thought to themselves, the Scriptures says this. The Messiah is going to free us politically. God is going to bless us. And He's going to kill our enemies. And then Jesus comes along like a tornado, and He lifts their house off of its foundations, tosses it about, sets it down so that they are no longer in Kansas. And we might think that they're still overreacting. But imagine that you were able to create your perfect life. I know that's far cry, but let's give it an attempt. Let's try. Let's try to think about what might be the perfect life. You have the perfect career that fulfills your personal needs for achievement and affirmation. Your spouse is wonderful and beautiful and the best friend you ever had. Your children always obey. They adore you. And they themselves are high achievers, just like you. Everything you wanted and dreamed of was at your fingertips. But then we get a new prime minister, and he gains power and in very short order transforms society and seizes your business, and now you work for him. And because he has slashed your seven-figure salary with stock options down to five figures, you're more stressed, you feel like a failure. You've given up, you have to give up your home and your winters in the Bahamas. And this leads to fights at your home, and your beautiful, adoring spouse leaves you. In addition, your children, once adoring and perfectly behaved, are impressionable and they see this new world and they find it strangely appealing and they join in this societal order, placing a wall between yourself and them. Who is to blame for your idyllic life falling apart? You blame the Prime Minister, of course. And that is why people try to assassinate presidents and prime ministers, and that is why the Jews wanted to kill Jesus. He had wrecked their life. Now, of course, Jesus is not a tyrant and he's not a dictator. Jesus is loving and he is merciful and he is gracious and he is compassionate. But the Jews could not see these things because their hearts were focused on Jesus challenging them by who he was. They wanted a puppet king, but Jesus could not be controlled. And this brings us to the primary point of the Jews confronting Jesus. It's this: the world will always challenge Christ's position and his person. I think that even if people in this world acknowledge God, if they somehow can do that, they want a divine being who they control. They want a God who gives them what they want. But otherwise, they just want him to stay out of the way. The hostility that often comes from unbelievers when they are told the truth of how a relationship with God works is because they want to rule their own lives. God is like this. But God says to them, I don't know who you are talking about. We make this argument. God is this way. But then God comes along and says, I don't know who that person is. One way to describe the Christian life is to say that it is the lifelong dedication to deprogramming and defending our hearts and minds from the ways and the beliefs of this world. One way to kind of look at what our life is about. But unfortunately, not every Christian is dedicated to the task. And even those who are, we're most of the time, we're out of our league. We have to be careful so that we are not like these Jews who represent a worldly viewpoint. How often do we challenge Christ's rule and his reign over our lives? Each time we sin, each time we exchange his desires for our life, for our own, and all of us, in some way or another, challenge the person of Christ as we create or distort his image. We challenge his authority in our lives when we create what we want to follow. An artist can look at a picture and maybe even have the skill to reproduce it with photographic precision. But with a small flourish, maybe a slightly different pigment of paint, they change it into something they create, something that is their very own. We all distort the image of Christ. We are to follow him purely as he is, but because we are fallible, because we are fallen, we cannot do so. No one serves Christ perfectly. We all worship a Savior who, if even with the tiniest little flourish, the slight different pigment of paint, we worship a Jesus who is not truly Jesus. We all try to make Jesus into one of us. And why? Sometimes it's because our faith is not true and we need the gospel to transform our hearts. We need the gospel to change who we are. But more often, for those who have faith that is real, it is because we think that we can claim some of God's authority over our lives. And that is why we do not find our rest. The Jews wanted to create their own Sabbath rest, and they butted heads against Jesus. When we try to find our own rest, our own peace, it's really going to come to no different of a conclusion. Why try to produce our own rest rather than turning to Jesus in full surrender? Because he is our only rest. After all this is said, Jesus has a position and we have a position. Jesus' position is that of authority over everything and everyone. Our position as Christians is that of submission to Christ above everyone and in everything. But why do we fail to submit? Why do we reclaim authority over our lives through such things as legalism? Why do we claim authority as we challenge Christ's position or even His person? Spurgeon wrote, "Self-sufficiency is Satan's net, wherein he catches men like poor, silly fish and does destroy them. Be not self-sufficient. Think yourselves nothing, for you are nothing, and live by God's help. The way to grow strong in Christ is to become weak in yourself." Why do we seek self-sufficiency rather than Christ's sufficiency? Why do we want to be autonomous? Why do we want to be rulers of our own lives? Why do we want to be captains of our own souls? Our souls long for joy and unrelenting fulfillment, and we trust little to this desire. We only entrust that desire to ourselves. And so we claim authority, and we pursue control over ourselves because we doubt God's promises that His command of our soul will lead us to safe harbors. And yet, how many times must we break against the rocks? How many times must we dash against the banks in one more storm to realize that being the captain of our souls leaves us shipwrecked? Has Jesus not shown us enough of His sacrificial love? Has He not demonstrated the magnitude of His grace? Has He not shown us the immeasurable extent of His mercy? The perfection of His compassion? Has He not shown us the unwavering beauty of His faithfulness? Has not the loveliness of Christ exceeded all that our eyes have ever seen? Does His voice not sing in our ears more delightful than any other song? Has He not shown Himself trustworthy again and again and again? I believe He has. And if you believe the same, like me, we continue to struggle to stay out of the captain's seat. So may we call out to God, who is patient and steadfast, full of grace. To use 1 Peter 5:6, we read this: "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time He may exalt you, casting all your anxieties on Him, because He cares for you." Let us pray.